My pleasure to welcome you here to the Clark Howard Show. You know, our mission is to serve and empower you so that you make better financial decisions in your life. Speaking of which, in today's episode, I want to talk about the crazy stuff going on in the stock market. GameStop has been all in the news, but they're just one of a handful of stocks that have been going just nutso in the last few weeks. I also have some great news for you on health insurance if you have suffered a job loss. So I want to talk to you about the GameStop thing. It's quite a buzz right now. I knew that this had really taken off when my 15-year-old son wanted me to explain to him what the deal was with GameStop, because he's looked at GameStop as just a has-been loser for a long time. You know, they've closed tons of stores. There's stores that are still open, look kind of sad, run down. And it's something that time seems to have passed by. But the value of GameStop has climbed. GameStop stock has climbed and climbed and climbed and climbed. And you may have heard some of the reporting about how this was really fueled on Reddit, and how Elon Musk was saying, hey, you know, buy GameStop. It's going to the moon. What about SpaceX? Aren't they going to the moon or Mars or something? Anyway, so this has become a mania, and it's been the revenge of very young investors. And so they have been bidding up this stock, and it's been people doing so in very small purchases, huge numbers of people. And GameStop really doesn't have a lot of intrinsic market value. Wall Street insiders, big time money people, have been playing a game called selling the stock short, which you may have heard the expression in the last few days. It's a financial maneuver where you're betting that you can buy a stock today, you can borrow a stock today, and then fund the borrowing of those shares later at lower prices. It's called shorting a stock. And that was probably a terrible explanation or definition, but the idea is the big money crowd on Wall Street had been betting on the extinction of GameStop. And then what the small investors have done, a lot of people in their teens and 20s, is they've been doing the opposite. They've been pushing the value of GameStop up. And then people who had bet on the shares dropping have had to do what's called unwind their positions, buy shares of an inflating stock price. And as they buy more, that pushes the price up in order to close out their positions and limit their losses. It has nothing to do with the actual real value of GameStop. This has also been happening with, remember there used to be the hottest device people carried was a BlackBerry? Well, there's also been happening with their stock, and I think about five or six others, where on message boards, people are saying, hey, let's run this one up, and they've been doing it. Now, generally, when people collude, that is an illegal activity. But this is not traditional private collusion. These are individuals stating on message boards. And as best as securities laws work today, as I understand them, it's not at all illegal. But the reality is these stocks that are being pushed up have none of the intrinsic value that the market suddenly is saying they're worth. And so this will end where these usually end with a bubble, is the value of these stocks are going to deflate. So it is what they call in investing theory, the greater fool. Who is the last one standing who rides it all the way down? You don't want to be you being the one who has to say, coulda, woulda, shoulda, sold earlier. And I want to know from Joel and Krista, have either of you been fighting the shorts on any of these stocks?
I have not, but I have to tell you, Clark, my 15-year-old son last night sent me a text while I was already in bed and said, what's my Social Security number? And I was like, well, why do you want to know that? And he said, I'm opening a Robinhood account. And I was like, you can't, you're 15. He was like, I want to do it anyway. And he wanted to get in on the stock trading. And he's like, why don't you open an account with your name and Social Security number? And I was like, absolutely not. So I'm definitely going to play this, make him listen to this segment of the podcast.
So our 15-year-olds are really into this, huh?
I know. They shouldn't hang out together and start their own little investing company.
Now, Joel, your oldest child is six, five?
Seven.
Seven. Is your seven-year-old wanting to open a Robinhood account?
No, this isn't on her radar yet, but that's definitely a sign of the times, though, right? I mean, think when things get this out of whack, this crazy with certain specific stocks and so much speculation, even the younger kids like are just like, oh, hey, anybody can get rich in the stock market. Let's do it. And yeah, I think you're right. There's going to be some people.
At least they're talking about it, right? It's got them interested.
But what I worry about, a good point, but what I worry about is this is 1999 all over again. When a bunch of younger, small investors got hyped up on all the original, what we now call the dot-bomb stocks, and ended up losing all that money, and then forward were cynical and distrusting of investing. And so the reality is I hold to my dull thing. I'm a dull person that, with investing, you always start core. You always start really wide with Dullsville, where you own large swaths of the stock market for the long haul. And then on the edges of that, what's called explore. If you want to do stuff like this, which is investing that's really gambling, then go right ahead, but never betting the real money you need for your future on it. I had somebody stop me the other day and say, because I drive a Tesla, and I got out of it. And he said, so did you get rich from the Tesla stock? I said, no, I've never owned Tesla stock. And he said, but you're into all this stuff. I said, well, you know, I only buy, because of what I do for a living, I don't buy individual stocks, so that no one will ever wonder why I'm saying what I say. But even if I was buying individual stocks, I don't buy stocks that have really run up way beyond their profits, and they're what are called story stocks. So over the long haul, the way you make money is being a turtle, slow and steady, no flash to it. And I know for a lot of people that's boring, that's dull. I want to build wealth and security so that my life doesn't have to be as dull as my investing strategies. Unfortunately, I ended up being dull anyway, so it didn't help. But the idea is that this is a situation that people take what's going on right now seriously, as if these are real values in companies that are being bid up by what people are doing on social media and Reddit boards and stuff like that. Let me tell you, these are not real values, and at some point, people are going to actually lose real money. Be careful. I am so terrible. I'm always telling people to eat their financial vegetables and not just eat candy and ice cream.
Everyone needs to hear it. And to my son, Matthew, get a job. All right, Clark, do you want to get to some questions?
Sure. Where do you want him to work?
Anywhere where he has to get super dirty and that he hates.
So my son, Grant, who's same age as Matt, knows that we are requiring that he have a job this summer. Mm-hmm. You know, that we're going to be out of quarantine and he's going to have a job. And so he's been talking to older schoolmates about where they've worked and stuff. And you should hear them trash talk the jobs they've had. Mm.
I mean, really, I just any job is good, right? And to enjoy it is even better. But it's good to experience jobs that are really tough and, you know.
Yeah, but see, I think it's great for every teenager to work in a job where you have direct customer contact, and you will learn the right way to treat people when you do that.
Mm-hmm.
You talk to anybody who's worked as a server in a restaurant, and they get to see people and their unvarnished selves, and people that are rude and mean, or people that are kind and friendly, and everything in between. And you see that in direct customer contact, and you learn the right way to behave. I want to tell a story about my oldest daughter, who is, she's all grown and gone now, 31, has a kid, wonderful husband, all that stuff. But when she first got out of college, she came out of college during the Great Recession, and there were really no jobs to be found. And so she took the job she could get, and she was doing direct customer contact in a veterinary medicine practice. And it was in the same zip code where she grew up in. And she would have people come in who were the parents of kids she went to school with, who were always so nice and friendly to her then, but then coming in for bringing their dog or cat or ferret or whatever in, that they wouldn't recognize her, and they'd treat her like dirt. And she was like, wow. And she learned a life lesson from that. A little later than we're talking about, that the reality is you're really setting an example every minute how you live your life, what kind of person you are and what kind of character you have. And I hope that any teenager learns from a job how important it is in life to be respectful of everyone you are around, whether it's personally, at work, in business, whatever it is, that being kind and decent to other people is a core principle you need to always hold on to. Now, what does that have to do with our podcast? Nothing at all. It's just on my mind.
Well, if you treat everyone well, you'll do better in life, right? And you'll have more opportunities.
That probably is true, but I don't think there needs to be an if-then. I think it's just the right thing.
Oh, I do too. I'm just saying, if you want to relate it somehow, if you are a decent person, yeah.
Yeah. So speaking of this, did you hear about the thing that happened at the Chick-fil-A with someone who was upset that they...
I did. I saw the video.
Joel, you look confused.
No, I didn't hear about this. What happened?
So this is a chilling video to watch. So they have all these coronavirus rules at Chick-fil-A, and this would-be customer went berserk and tried to hurt employees at the Chick-fil-A and damage the store.
Ugh.
Because they were being told to, mask up or whatever. And it's just...
Yeah, they
ridiculous.
Got kicked out, and then they came around to the drive-thru and were trying to crawl through the drive-thru window and then threw bricks at the window. And, you know, the Chick-fil-A employees, as Joel once worked for Chick-fil-A,
right.
are the most polite people on the planet. And I don't think that those customers got a my pleasure when they got their order.
Definitely not a my pleasure.
My goodness.
Well, I'll tell you what our pleasure is, and that's to answer your questions. But I want to talk about some key news about health insurance. If you or someone you know has lost a job during the pandemic, you got to hear what I have to say straight ahead. There are many, many millions of Americans who have lost jobs that at first they thought they were only temporarily being furloughed from. And when they lost the jobs, they lost their health coverage. And, you know, on our podcast, we got a lot of questions from people about health coverage. And it can be very confusing, and the prices can be frightening. But what has happened because of these new layoffs is the Biden administration has reopened the healthcare exchanges around the country, which normally are only available for a tight period, early November to mid-December each year for the following year. So we were done for 21. But now, for a number of circumstances, the exchanges are reopened. And historically, if you had a recent job loss where you lost coverage, you would be able to do what's known as a special enrollment period. But it had a lot of hoops you had to jump through. Now you don't have to. If you want to see what health coverage would cost for you or if you're buying for a family, you can go to healthcare.gov and then it'll ask your state and it'll take you to the federal state exchange for your state. Some states, it's just a straight federal exchange. Others, it looks a little different than the federal one. But the idea is how you buy the coverage is pretty similar everywhere. You'll have a choice of color-coded plans that are generally bronze, silver, or gold. Most people buy silver plans, and the silver plans will have the same basic requirements regardless of which insurer you buy it from. The deductibles will be similar. They'll all pretty much have the same kind of aspects to them. What will be different from one plan to another is whether doctors that you want to use are included and hospitals that you like to visit, if you have to go to a hospital, that the hospitals are included. Now, what you'll see when you first go onto the exchange is you'll see premiums and potentially, based on your income, subsidies that greatly reduce those premiums. Now, these plans are what are known as compliant. You cannot be excluded because of pre-existing conditions, and they can't exclude care for you for different things. Now, you can buy policies if you've lost your job that are ones that are what are called non-compliant. They don't have to take you based on pre-existing conditions, and they can tightly limit how they cover you. Those plans may appear to be much cheaper, and the premiums typically are, but if you do get a bad illness, then they're not useless, but they pretty much are. So the advantage of a non-compliant plan is they usually don't have the very high deductibles that you have with a real plan. But then at the other end, if you have major expenses, you're majorly out of luck with those non-compliant plans. When you buy at healthcare.gov, you're buying real comprehensive insurance. If you don't qualify for subsidies, the premiums are astronomical. You will have meaningful deductibles that can be a lot of money, but once you've met those, the plans very heavily cover your health care. It's time for your questions. You posted for me at clark.com/ask. And Krista?
Hey, Clark. So this was sent in by Todd in Florida. He says, as Clark advises, I made my teen children authorized users on one of my credit cards to help with their credit scores. They are both now married adults. One is 27 and one is 24. Will it negatively affect their credit if I remove them as an authorized user? If so, is there a way to determine how much an effect there would be?
Yeah, so the effect ultimately is determined by how much other credit they've established for themselves. If your adult children now have gotten two or more major credit cards in their names, maybe they've got a mortgage, car loan, then removing them from authorized user status will have minimal impact. On the other hand, if your adult kids have not gotten their own meaningful lines of credit of their own, then you would impact them quite heavily by removing them as authorized users. So I'm assuming that they understood the drill, they got their own credit, they've been out on their own for a while, in which case it's absolutely fine for you to close that authorized user status. It will have a minor impact, but typically not a meaningful one for you removing them. Joel?
Clark, Michael in Utah says, hey, Clark, during a 1031 exchange, can you potentially not use the entire amount of the proceeds that you get from the sale of your home? Meaning if I sold a property for $150,000 and then I wanted to roll that into a $120,000 property, the net difference would be $30,000. Would I pay capital gains on that $30,000?
So this is funny. I have never had somebody ask me about doing a 1031 exchange where they didn't end up buying a property equal or more expensive. And just so you know what we're talking about, if you have investment real estate, there is a tax code, the 1031 section of the tax code, that allows you to roll the gain from the sale of the first investment property into a new one and avoid having the tax bill now. You defer the tax you would owe on the gain from the first property. You have to go through special hoops where you have what's known as a qualified intermediary who holds the proceeds from the sale of the first property, and you must identify in roughly 6 weeks the next property you want to buy, and then you buy that property. In the rare circumstance where the new property is less expensive than the one you have sold, then the difference would be subject to capital gains. But paying capital gains is not the end of the world. In fact, I chose with an investment property a while back not to defer the gain in a 1031 because tax rates have been so low that it made sense to me just to pay the tax at today's rates rather than deferring the gain to a point in the future where tax rates likely will be higher than they are right now. Krista?
This is from Winter in Washington. Last year, I continued making payments towards the principal on my federal student loans. There is another pause on student loan payments for borrowers until September of 2021. My current balance is close to $30,000 spread over 5 loans with an interest rate of 4%. I'm trying to decide if I should work towards paying off one of my loans before September, which is $1,600, or if I focus on paying the total remaining interest of $1,680. I'm thinking it would be great to pay off one of my loans, but is it beneficial to pay off the interest before it starts accruing again after September? What do you suggest?
So the idea of going ahead and paying on loans when you don't have to is actually a viable strategy because you pay these loans off, you're not going to have interest on them once interest payments resume, probably in October, you will have wiped out that debt. Now you could, as an alternative, although what you can earn on interest and savings right now is ultra low, you could just keep putting that money in savings and then dump it all against your federal student loans in October. But that seems like that's more effort than it's worth. You right now can pay down on those balances, benefit from the 0% interest. When interest rates resume, you will have reduced the amount of obligations you have subject to interest. And this is a very viable idea for people who have stayed employed, whose income has remained solid, for you to continue on the path of paying down on your student loan debt. I know that what I just said is different than every other article that's been written about this, saying, why wouldn't you just sit still, sit on your hands, and wait till interest resumes when payments are required again, maybe starting in October? But I think the discipline of paying on those loans and being able to pay on them with all the money going to principal is very much to your advantage. Joel?
Clark, Barbara in North Carolina says, is it okay to download tax software on a financial Chromebook?
Yes. That is something that I would think is A-okay to do. And if I have not mentioned enough, 70% of taxpayers qualify to use free tax preparation software by starting at irs.gov, look for the free file icon, click on it, and you'll see all the various software programs that are available to use to prepare and file your income tax for free. Now, why is it only 70% of taxpayers? That's the percent of taxpayers that have an income less than $72,000 a year, and that's who qualifies for free tax prep. Krista?
I have another student loan question from Emily in Ohio. She says, I have student loans that I pay on each month. They began as federal loans and then private companies bought them. I had no control over this. I would like to be able to take advantage of the executive order of zero interest on my loans. I was told I do not qualify because my loans are privately held. Do I have any other option or recourse?
Okay, I have no idea what the backstory is there, because federal loans don't just involuntarily convert to private loans. It seems like at some point somebody cheated you, and that's the only explanation I could give. Private student loans are poison to your pocketbook almost always. There are rights and privileges, and in this case, there's a clear example with the payment holidays and interest holidays on federal loans. And I am just totally befuddled by how in the world your federal student loans became private. Krista, do you mind sending a message back, seeing if you can get more understanding about
Sure.
how in the world that happened? And, you know, the student loan thing is a problem in so many different ways. And I think with $1.7 trillion outstanding on student loans, that we're going to have lending reform in the United States, and it can't come a minute too soon. Have a great day, and I hope you've enjoyed today's podcast. If you did, let other people know. If you didn't, let us know how I failed to serve you at clark.com/clarkstinks.